You're listening to the Safety of Work podcast, episode 115. Today, we're asking the question, why are subcontractors at higher risk? Let's get started. Hey, everybody. My name's David Proven, and I'm here with Drew Ray, and we're from the Safety Science Innovation Lab at Griffith University in Australia. Welcome to the Safety of Work podcast. In each episode, we ask an important question in relation to the safety of work or the work of safety, and we examine the evidence surrounding it. So today we're going to be talking about subcontractors. And for many organizations, particularly in high hazard industries, you know, subcontractors form a portion, maybe even a large portion of their workforce. And you know, from memory, Drew, I don't think we've done too many episodes on safety research associated with subcontractors yet. So, you know, before we dive into this episode, I thought it'd be good to get your perspective on where you see the current state of safety research in relation to subcontracting.
Sure, David, and hi, everyone. It's always been assumed that subcontractors are at higher risk than other workers. It gets talked about a lot in the academic literature. I think it's fairly widely assumed across industry. But it's fairly hard to pin down or prove that it's the case, mainly because subcontractors tend to do different work to other employees. And so it's sort of hard to disentangle what's due to the subcontracting relationship, what's due to the nature of work, and all the usual problems of reporting that make it hard to count sort of who is at higher or lower risk. Subcontracting itself is also a fairly undefined term. It can range from anything from large labor hire organizations to small, what we typically think in Australia of a subby, a small business with maybe 1 to 4 or 5 employees. But technically, one large organization subcontracting to another large organization is also subcontracting, even though all the employees are permanent in both organizations. So it's a bit hard to disentangle exactly what we mean. And it can be hard to do solid research because commercial contracts tend to act as a stopping point for research projects. Say I get hired by a parent company to research, then I can't go and talk directly to the employees of the subcontractor. And typically, the smaller a subcontractor is, the more that they're sort of getting paid by the hour. So any time they spend talking to researchers is time that they need to be paid for by somebody, which means that we tend to do more research in big organizations than we do in subcontractors.
And so, Drew, the research paper that we'll introduce and discuss shortly, the literature review there talked about different theoretical perspectives on why subcontractors might be at higher risk. There's a social science, like individual perspective. Maybe there's something associated with the workers themselves. There's a sort of the systemic theorists that actually look at, you know, what are some of the systems breakdowns or potential breakdowns which can create or increase risk with those types of arrangements. And then there's the complexity theorists that are really looking even more broadly as well. I thought maybe because the paper we're going to talk about today is from, a PhD that you supervised, I thought maybe you might want to just talk a little bit about that broad body of research, and then we can go and introduce the paper for today.
Okay, I won't go too deeply into it. You've sort of pointed out the main three categories there. So the social science approach mainly doesn't focus specifically on safety. It focuses on the whole area of precarious and contingent work. And the idea is that these are people who are in vulnerable situations because they don't have secure employment. And those vulnerable situations makes them, for example, less likely to report injuries, less likely to speak up, more likely to get told to go and do dangerous work, and less able to say no if they do get told to do it. The system approach more looks at things like financial pressures, the idea of contracting relationships which create the need to be sort of constantly making progress and constantly delivering and not having time to spend on sort of nice-to-haves like safety. And then the complexity goes into issues such as things like communication and management of competency and the way once you have multi-organizational arrangements, you no longer have one nice, clean safety management system. You no longer have one nice, clean reporting system. You don't have long-term management of things like culture and competency. And so all of the normal protections we put in place for safety just don't work as well when there are contract boundaries in place.
So, Drew, I mean, I find this fascinating. Having worked in industry for a long time, and I still hear it a lot with the companies that I get to sort of spend time with, you know, there is this feeling that, you know, contractors are, you know, are higher risk. And so you were fortunate to supervise, I guess, Sharan's PhD in this space. So do you want to maybe introduce him and then this paper, and then we can get stuck into it?
Okay, I'll give a bit of background of the whole PhD, just to put this paper into context. So this was a scholarship that actually came out of a subcontractor fatality. After the fatality, there was an enforceable undertaking. Part of that enforceable undertaking established a scholarship to look at subcontractor safety. And because this is such a hard topic to research, basically what Sharan did is he wrote four papers, each looking at the issue from a different angle. In one paper, he sort of ran a workshop of principal contractors and subcontractors to talk about the issues in focus groups. In another paper, he was out in the field talking to people as they're at work. And in this particular paper, he was looking at fatality records. So looking at actual cases where subcontractors had been killed to look at whether there were circumstances in those fatalities that were linked to the fact that they were subcontractors. Just give the background as we usually do. The authors are Sharan Valaru, who is the PhD student, now Dr. Valaru, myself, and Professor Sydney Decker. The title is Behind Subcontractor Risk, a Multiple Case Study Analysis of Mining and Natural Resources Fatalities. Pretty much the paper does what it says on the tin. A journal called Safety. We've done a number of papers coming from Safety. It's an open access journal. The paper was published in 2020, so pretty recent.
So, Drew, you mentioned the perspective of the different papers, and this paper, you know, this study really tries to take the perspective of the subcontractor and explore the ways that this viewpoint, you know, the subcontractor's viewpoint sort of interacts with safety management systems and processes. So there were six fatality investigation reports that, I guess, met the criteria to be included and to be reviewed, all associated with fatalities occurring to subcontractors on mine sites in Queensland between 2004 and 2014. Drew, do you want to talk a little bit about the analysis method? So you start with six fatality investigation reports, and, you know, where do you start, and, you know, how do you do that kind of analysis?
Okay, using accident investigation reports as data is always a bit of a problem, because even though, you know, this is probably the rawest and most authentic way we have of actually investigating at safety or unsafety. Sharan sort of came out of these archives kind of in a bit of shock from just reading all of the details of these accounts. But the trouble is the data's already been filtered through the original investigators. So whatever training they have and whatever frameworks they're using tend to get reproduced in the reports. So when people just take whole bunches of accident reports and summarize them, what you tend to do is reproduce the frameworks that the investigators were using to do the analysis. To get around this, we got reports where they weren't specifically looking at subcontracting issues in the original investigation. And then we used the frameworks that came from the literature. So the framework of the contingent work, or the framework of breakdowns of systems, or the framework of long-term safety mechanisms aren't working well. And so that sort of coming at right angles or sideways to the original investigation is a good way of getting something new out of raw data. It sort of particularly helps in this case because they weren't published reports. And that means that there was more original data there available in the files that Sharan could look at. You know, once things have to be publicly published, they tend to get highly sanitized. Lots of the extra stuff gets removed. And it becomes harder to get anything new out of a report that's already been overanalyzed. So we're sort of looking at in-depth at each of these six cases, and looking for anything that resonates with that literature, that matches those existing explanations, and then diving deeper anytime we sort of see that resonance occurring.
So are we ready to talk about the findings?
Yeah, I think we can just go straight into the findings.
So at a high level, I'll sort of introduce the four high-level findings, and then we might speak about each one of these in detail as was done in the discussion of the paper. But it seems that this research, you know, identified themes that matched, you know, two pre-existing kind of like theories and frameworks, that these two being that institutional safety mechanisms do not cope well with the variability introduced by subcontractors. So the standing safety management systems and safety management activities don't quite match the context of subcontractor work. And the second is that expertise in the work doesn't necessarily translate in expertise to this in the safety of that work. You know, so a contractor knows very intimately and detailed and lots of experience with doing their work, but you know, that doesn't necessarily mean they know how to do that job as safely as they could. Do you want to say anything about those, anything initially about those two? And before I...
I think we're going to take a deep dive into all four of these.
And so the other two were sort of more new categories, so patterns in this research that weren't well previously explained or in the existing literature. The first was around communication, not flowing to the subcontractors from the layers above them. And there's a couple of different aspects to that communication, which we'll talk about. And the second is that the safety work activities are viewed differently by subcontractor staff compared to principal contractors and operators. So some of the things that the customer is expecting the subcontractor to do has a different meaning to the client than it does to the customer and gets treated differently. So are we ready to dive into the first one then, Drew?
Sure. So our first one is about the institutional safety mechanisms. And the overarching theme behind this theme is that the way in which some of these things look from a client or principal contractor is very different when you look at them backwards in the other direction, meaning that they don't work as well. So like the classic example of that is a subcontractor might be only on site for a short time, but they're on many sites for that short amount of time. So something like an induction, which is really useful for someone who's coming on site for an extended period of time, becomes 18 different inductions that are not as meaningful to someone who has to sit through every one of them. That can get worse when there's actually different rules occurring at different times on different sites. So, you know, not only do you have 18 inductions, you've got to remember that page 7 of them was the actual key difference and suddenly switches when you go to a different site. What else can we say about that one?
So I think, Drew, I think for me, like a company, you know, formal safety management arrangements, safety management systems, formal safety activities, you know, when you're on a site and you get to know how that all works, it can feel very obvious and easy to understand and easy to use and is designed more for the ongoing management of that site. When you're a subcontractor and you then come onto that site and you look at all of this stuff that's being done, induction over here and checklist and form over there and this meeting that you have to attend, it doesn't make that much necessarily that much sense. And I think in this research, what was interesting was, you know, even not involving subcontractors in a lot of those activities, like you said, oh, I'm just going to be here for one day, so you don't need to do the induction or something like that. So you've got arrangements that don't work or arrangements that aren't applied.
Yeah, I think we have a assumption that we don't tend to talk about a lot with safety management systems, which is that, okay, we know that not everyone reads the safety management system. In fact, we know that hardly anyone reads it. We know that people tune in and out during training and inductions and pre-starts. But the assumption is that if you're on the same site or with the same company for an extended period of time, it just sort of seeps into the way everyone works. So, you know, even if you don't read it on this particular day, even if you weren't listening on that particular moment, you get a general sense of the way things are done, the way things are supposed to be done. It creates a routine and a structure and a regularity to work. And those sorts of mechanisms don't apply when people are only getting short, sharp exposures. They're highly reliant on hearing every word in the induction because every word might be important. It can't just be the case that they're going to hear that same induction over and over. They're going to hear different ones at different times in different places.
And I mean, we even see in some organizations like the subcontractors can't access certain documentation, certain systems, you know, aren't involved in certain activities. So it's not that it isn't applied or it doesn't work. It's just that they physically can't get involved in those safety management arrangements.
Yep.
So the second one then is that this expertise in work doesn't translate into expertise in safety. Do you want to overview that one?
So the sort of theme behind the theme here is that most of the subcontractors that were involved in these fatalities had started off as very, very small one or two people organizations, and had grown. And as they'd grown, whereas a large organization will have lots of specialization, in the small organization, lots of people are doing many different tasks. So, you know, the owner of the organization does the books, and sometimes they're driving the forklift, and sometimes they're doing the training, and sometimes they're doing the supervision of other people. And so there's lots more multitasking going on and sort of a multi-expertise multitasking. It's far more often that a supervisor will need to step in and be the extra person doing a task, which sort of takes them away from being a supervisor into being a doer, because there's less defined roles, less opportunity to pull people from elsewhere in the organization. The other thing is that the subcontractor may be called in because they've got expertise in a particular type of work, but they're in an environment where they don't have expertise. So the classic thing there is electricians down coal mines. They're there because the coal mine needs an electrician, but they're not used to working in a coal mining environment. They're not used to other hazards. They're not even necessarily aware of the electrical safety hazards, how those change when you're in a coal mine. And so, yeah, they'll often be at danger doing specialized work just because the environment has changed the safety of that work.
Yeah, and I think there was another example in one of the accident reports around operating a certain type of equipment. And it's one thing to say, yes, I've operated a loader before, but, you know, not necessarily operated that loader on that site. So unfamiliar roads, unfamiliar equipment. And I think in one of those fatalities, there was actually a functioning emergency brake that the operator, you know, we can only assume didn't have any knowledge of the emergency braking system on that particular piece of equipment. So yes, I've got general expertise in loader operations or something like that, but I may not have site-specific expertise that's relevant to managing the risks for that specific task on that specific site.
That example of the loader is really quite representative. So a subcontractor may often have to use equipment that's supplied by the principal contractor. So they're just switching from whatever equipment happens to be available. Very often, they're less likely to own their own equipment. So they may, in fact, hire the equipment for that particular day to do that particular job. And when you're hiring equipment, you're likely to get a slightly different model to the equipment that you had last time. You know, it does basically the same job, but it's got the brake in a different place or a slightly different function or a slightly different feature or a slightly different tipping point. And so, yeah, that sort of regularity that you get when you're with a large company owning its own equipment, all the equipment is the same, breaks down when you're in a subcontractor who are hired specifically to create flexibility. So they then become those sufferers of the flexibility that they're there to create.
The third theme from the research, Drew, is that sort of titled communication does not flow from the subcontractor to the subcontractor from the layers above them. We'll talk a little bit about communication.
This is probably the most boring and least surprising finding from the study. But I think the one thing to drive home here is just how hard this is. That, you know, getting information to subcontractors requires explicit effort because there are so many barriers that can just stop it falling in. And this is information like disruption, changes to site conditions. You know, our normal way of distributing information about site-specific conditions is maybe at our pre-start briefing. But the contractor who only comes in for 2 hours in the afternoon has not had the pre-site briefing. This tends to get worse as we have more players on site and more people coming in and out. I kind of suspect myself that maybe there's a sweet spot when people are fully aware that they're going to have lots of subcontractors. They explicitly set systems up. But yeah, as you get the first couple and as that number starts to increase, that's when communication really starts to break down. But there's other types of information like previous incidents that have gone wrong and safety alerts that might come down from a regulator are far less likely to reach subcontractors. They come sort of centrally through the company's central management systems. They appear on the intranet. They get handed out through the company email. The subcontractors aren't on the mailing list. They're not on the intranet. They're not going to see that unless it's like specifically handed to them as a piece of paper or sent specifically to them as an email. So there's just got that less awareness of what's going on, both things that have gone well and things that have gone wrong that might be important for you managing their own safety.
Yeah, Drew, I think in one of the incidents associated with tyre changes, there was an industry-wide alert from the regulator, you know, a year prior or so about, you know, that sequence of events and the risk. And yeah, I guess the large mining companies, or in this case, the clients, they're set up to receive that information, to update their processes, to communicate it. But that information isn't received directly necessarily by the subcontractors. And, you know, there could be an assumption that everyone knows that you deal with this risk in this way. But you can't have that assumption with subcontractors because the information just doesn't easily flow to them. And I think also, Drew, that the amount of complexity with communicating, like you said, how hard this is, because you've got site managers, you've got procurement managers, you've got you know, engineers, you've got the subcontractor management structure itself. Like you said, it's just endless opportunity for information to not get to the person who's doing the work.
Yeah, the very idea of an industry-wide alert, you've got to stop for a moment and think, okay, what industry, how do we identify everyone in that industry? You know, even in this imaginary perfect world where every single company that did mining got an alert about mining, the subcontractor that was killed was not a mining company. They were a vehicle maintenance company. So, you know, they're only going to receive that alert if it comes first to a mining company, and that mining company makes a point of telling all of their subcontractors. There are always multiple layers, and whenever there's extra layers, there's extra chances for things to be lost.
And even that becomes point in time, because even if you made the effort to communicate with all of your contractors, then 3 months later, you engage a new contractor that with that deliberate effort to go back and look at that scope and what might this contractor not know that we should provide them. We're starting to get in this conversation now beyond what I've seen companies being able to do in this space, but maybe we can deal with that with the practical takeaways. So Drew, the fourth theme then is this theme of safety work is viewed differently by subcontractor staff compared with the operators or principal contractors. So do you want to talk a little bit about that?
So remember, there are sort of two confirmations of existing theory and two new things that came out. Communication was one of the new thing, technically new, but not that interesting. This particular one, though, I think was really insightful. Safety is generally not a core operational task. We would like to say, you know, safety is central and important. But the fact is that if the safety work doesn't happen, it doesn't actually prevent the work from happening. And that ratio and calculation is different for a big long-term organization and a smaller flexible organization. We hire subcontractors because we want short-term thinking. Otherwise, we would just do that work ourselves as permanent employees long-term. But when you're working on shorter timeframes with more flexibility, then doing non-core work has a much proportionally greater cost. And because of that, that means that things that would seem to be, oh, that's just a little bit of extra for safety, but it's really important, for a subcontractor becomes, that's a really big burden, and it's not that relevant or important. And so it's actually, you know, what counts as reasonable to expect people to do becomes quite different depending on what time scale you look, which is, yeah, we might talk about this in practical takeaways. It's really quite challenging that, you know, it becomes very, very important then that everything we ask subcontractors to do is of value, and very, very important to make sure that there is some financial way of paying them for that value. Because otherwise, it's just not, it may seem a little bit strange, but it's not worth their while to care about safety, because caring about safety would be just such a big burden compared to the other work that they need to get done.
Yeah, I agree. Drew, just this general expectation that all of the safety things get done. You know, there's a couple of examples in the case studies. One was specifically, I think, about inspection and maintenance record keeping for safety, and about equipment checks and things like that, which didn't really impact the subcontractor on the given day because the equipment works or it doesn't work. But just, you know, the time that it would take to complete all of that record keeping that the client wanted. But from a contractor's perspective, we're not getting paid to maintain these records and do all these checks and follow your management systems. So, you know, at best, you get a very efficient, superficial compliance activity performed, which I think to this theme looks very different to what the client company is intending from that activity.
Yeah. Just to drive the point home, it's not just about sort of like reluctance to do things that are of obvious value. Record keeping is more valuable for an organization that has got a horizon of a couple of years. Once you're looking a couple of years ahead, records become vital. If you're doing jobs that are only of a couple of weeks, then keeping records isn't of that much value to you. It's a value to the larger organization, not to the small organization doing the work. Another sort of core example here is safety management systems. There's a minimum cost to establish and maintain a bare bones safety management system. I don't know exactly what it would be. It might be sort of half an employee per year. Now, if you're in an organization of 10,000 people, you might go well beyond that minimum cost, and having a whole person working just on your safety management system, maybe having a couple of people, is still only, what, you know, 0.5% of your workforce. If you've got 10 people, there's no way you can devote 0.5% just to your minimum quality safety management system. Of course, it's going to be taking shortcuts and having records not filled in and having procedures that aren't there, because you're, even the bare bones thing is an overhead that you can't afford.
And I think, Drew, in one of the examples in this research, the subcontractor, like you mentioned earlier, was small and was working under the client safety management system. And then the client decided that, well, you're getting a little bit big now, you should probably have your own safety management system. And they went and just, like you said, went and got a consultant to give them something off the shelf. And then, you know, the client had to keep rejecting this system as not being complete, not being adequate. But I think it was a mismatch of expectation of expecting that company to create something equivalent to the quality and depth of, you know, a very large mining organization as a very small contracting organization. I just don't think that was going to work.
No, particularly not if you wanted the two systems to be able to talk to each other and to be able to share communications and report up and down. And you expect that subcontractor to work for other companies that have got other management systems that they have to interface with as well.
So, Drew, anything else you want to add to the research or the findings before we go to our takeaways?
No, that's fairly short, but I think that's good summary of the findings. I don't want to sort of like overblow what was found.
Okay, so let's talk. I threw a couple of takeaways down here, Drew, in the prep, and I'm keen to get your thoughts on it. The first one, you said it's not very interesting, the communication one, or maybe it's not very surprising. But I think the communication piece for me is, you know, like the practical takeaway there is you need to have very dedicated and deliberate contractor communication processes. You can't rely on your existing, you know, toolboxes and, you know, emails and alerts and reporting systems and whatever your standard safety communication mechanisms are. You can't just rely on those, you know, make that information making its way to your contractors. I think an organization needs to have a very deliberate set of contractor comms processes that are two-way.
Yes. I'll go a step beyond that, David, and say that you don't just need systems, you need plans as well. As in, you need a set of types of information that are going to need to be conveyed. Understanding that some of that is not just going to be at a particular point of time, it's going to be storing up information so that new contractors get a store of information from the last 6 months that may be things that have been sent out to all the previous contractors. But also, you know, it's got to actively manage the volume of that as well to make sure that you're not giving them so much information that they can't deal with it. So, and that's why it needs to be dedicated. It needs to be something that is capable of doing that sort of filtering and tailoring and prioritization and time shifting. You can't just adapt your normal communication channels to just happen to also include subcontractors. It's not going to work.
The second takeaway I had, Drew, there is around this idea that the safety management systems and formal safety arrangements don't sort of suit the context of subcontractor work. And in many of our safety management systems, you might just have one element that's contractor management. It might be one of 11 or 12 elements of your management system. And I'd almost go as far as to say, you know, that an organization may want to have a safety management system and then almost a completely separate, but obviously interfaced contractor safety management system, which actually looks at all of the elements of safety management and all of the activities for safety. And how does that apply in the context of contractors? You know, incident investigation, risk management, auditing, training, induction, leadership, all these things, and go, okay, well, that's how we do it for our organization. But how do we actually do all of these things specifically with our contractors? Because I think there's just kind of an expectation at the moment. It's just kind of like, we'll just include our contractors in all the normal stuff that we do.
Can I modify that slightly, David, and say that then there needs to be at least two different things. One of them is there has to be a system for managing contractors who are small enough that you don't expect them to have large systems of their own, so that you can basically bring them into part of your own management system. They're not employees, but most of the aspects of safety are still going to need to be handled through your systems because they don't have those systems themselves or the capacity to take on the management of those systems. For other subcontractors, there needs to be a way of your safety management system interfacing with theirs without imposing undue burden. So without expecting them to be able to modify theirs to interface with yours and to interface with the five other systems that they need to interface with. You know, every time you ask someone to pre-qualify, you'll basically ask them to create a new interface onto their management system to meet the pre-qualification. And that's just not reasonable. That's passing work onto the subcontractors, taking responsibility for meeting the interface where it's at.
No, I like that, Drew. Thank you. The third that I had there is around verifying expertise. So in the paper, it sort of talked about that we pre-qualify, like you mentioned then, Drew, or we check for licenses and certifications, and we make assumptions that people do this work all the time. They know how to do it safely. But being very, very clear that what do I need to do to be confident that this contractor can manage their work in my specific context? So using maybe equipment that I provide or doing it in my underground mine or something like that. So they may have good task expertise, but do they have the expertise to, you know, manage the risk of that task in this situation? And I think that needs careful sort of cooperative discussion.
Yeah, the idea of pre-qualification, we could have a whole separate podcast about it, but it's a misunderstanding of the obligation. We are creating the work environment that the subcontractor is coming into. It's our obligation to make sure that that work environment is safe for them. And part of that means them understanding what it takes to work safely within our environment. And unless your pre-qualification system is run by people who are also creating your environment and know your environment and are doing that sort of matching, then you're not checking the right things through pre-qualification anyway.
And I think we should do that pre-qualification podcast, Drew. Number four was about how we include critical non-core work within the specific scope of the contracts and make those expectations clear, and obviously then pay our contractors for doing that. So at the moment, we might be paying a contractor to drill a hole or replace some equipment or build something for us. And that's the core work, whatever it's going to take to actually build that thing. But if we want all these other safety activities and non-core peripheral work so that the overall experience of that work is at the standard and the level of risk that we want, then we need to pay for that. And many of the contracts I see just have comply with all safety requirements. And how's a contractor meant to cost that up and know what to do? You know, clients should be very specific about all of the non-core work expectations, and they should be included in work scopes. And then the contractors can give, you know, that work the same importance as getting the core task done.
Yeah, I see that one as an ethical responsibility, is if you're not telling people specifically what long-term safety work you want done and making sure that that's costed out, then you're implicitly asking people to skimp on that part of their quoting and their delivery. And that's just not ethical.
Agree, Drew. And then the last one I had there was about, you know, maybe, you know, notwithstanding everything that we've talked about on this podcast, there was a comment that, you know, these longer term partnering arrangements or working with contractors over a longer period of time may mediate some of these challenges with subcontractors, because you do end up, you know, maybe getting to know each other's capabilities, expertise, build some communication channels, integrate your systems, you know, align on what's important to be done. And so maybe, you know, more partnering, longer term relationships can, you know, moderate some of these challenges.
Yeah, the slight modification I'd make to that one is I think for that to happen, safety needs a voice in the selection of subcontractors. It doesn't come directly from this study, but the number of times I've heard we select the subcontractors for cost and then we expect the safety team to sort it out and get them up to standard, rather than recognizing that actually your selection of subcontractors and your maintenance of those relationships is a core safety activity for both parties.
Yeah, maybe a bonus activity, a bonus takeaway, Drew, not consistent with the paper, but based on what you said, is align the KPIs of your supply chain team and your safety team. Because I did run into a situation in an organization where the supply chain team had an express KPI to lower supply chain costs by 10%. So they went out and retendered everything and went to reduce cost. And it meant the removal of certain contractors that the safety team had been working with for 3 to 5 years to get up to a really good standard. And then obviously the supply chain team, based on their incentive, which was find someone cheaper, introduced a whole lot of risk. Now, maybe that's the trade-off the company wants to make, but that should be a really known trade-off when teams are working slightly at cross purposes at times.
So, David, the question we asked this week, why are subcontractors at higher risk?
I think the short answer in some of it is that, you know, there's lots of filtered and missing communication towards contractors, gaps in situational specific expertise that don't get identified, and just our broad safety management systems and arrangements that don't work well for the subcontractor context.
So that's it for this week. We hope you found this episode thought-provoking and ultimately useful in shaping the safety of work in your own organization. David, where can people get us these days?
LinkedIn, all your favorite podcast channels. And look forward to getting on track with Fortnightly episodes for 2024.
Okay. Thanks, David.
Thanks, everyone.